a hunter, not the hunted. Nothing happened that night. It watched. I watched it watch. When eventually the creature loped off, dawn was just around the corner. I headed down to the area where the figure had been. Though I wasn't an expert ranger by any means, certain things were clear. The creature walked upright, at least some of the time. The footprints were heavy in the damp sod. It didn't leave any lasting magical sign in the area. And it had some measure of patience, or at least a ritual or routine that it stuck to. I followed the tracks back into the foothills, but eventually the trail went cold. At least I had an idea of where it might be coming from. I covered my own trail as best I could and headed back up to camp. After casting my augmentation, I laid down to sleep away the morning and early afternoon, wrapped in a dew-covered blanket from head to toe. I would need a long rest in order to memorize my magical arsenal for the next night. I was well prepared for this, pushing the reservoir of my intellect right to the limit of my current power level. This would allow me to prepare and cast a few cantrips, 3 basic spells, and 3 more advanced spells without risking permanent damage to my mind. I decided on a purely offensive routine. Once our paths crossed, I had no plans to be subtle. As the afternoon gave way to night, dark clouds gathered. I was worried. If the night was going to be overcast, perhaps the thief would wait for a more clear and well-lit night. I needn't have worried. As with most rainstorms these days, it didn't last long. Enough water fell from the sky to tease thirsty plants and hopeful farmers, but not much more. Within an hour, the clouds had retreated. This time, I didn't have to wait long. The creature was brazen. It approached from exactly the same hill that it had used to scout its prey the night before. The full moon had just crested over the horizon, and it was very likely that some humans were still awake in the farmhouse. Pursuit from the locals could be started in less than 10 minutes if this creature was detected. I waited until the wind shifted, blowing from the slightly pungent fields onto the damp hillsides. Knowing that my own scent couldn't carry to the creature, I quietly made my way closer. It meant losing sight of the thief as I descended from my larger hill and mounted the smaller one that was close to where the creature entered the valley. A few minutes later, I struggled to spot the interloper. In fact, I was struggling to keep myself oriented. A light fog had rolled in due to the cool night air being unable to hold all of the recent moisture. I had this sickening feeling in the pit of my stomach. Low visibility, unfamiliar ground, only the scent of cattle in the air. It felt like I had possibly trapped myself. In just a few minutes, nature had turned me from the hunter into the prey. It had never occurred to me that a sheep might someday save my life. But when the panicked bleating reached my ears, I knew exactly where the danger was. I turned quickly and got my footing on the hillside. At least I would have a fighting chance. Then again, it had never occurred to me that a sheep might someday try to kill me. The memory is etched in my mind forever. Out of the mist, it got larger, far too quickly. The fluffy white quadruped, mouth hanging open in a protracted scream. Those 4 fuzzy limbs flailing for purchase but finding nothing but air. This sheep wasn't charging. It was flying. A fluffy living boulder. A ruminant missile. The grazing impact of the sheep's sturdy chest upon my shoulder probably saved it from multiple broken legs, as knocking me down stole much of the fuzzy beast's momentum. Sadly, the impact sent me tumbling down the hillside. I tried to get my bearings. I was near the bottom of the grassy hill, somewhat close to its more rocky neighbor. The conjoining of the 2 hills formed a natural footpath. I had emerged with just scrapes and bruises, but disorientated as the real threat arrived. The first tomahawk came in low and flew between my legs even as I stood up. I quickly held up my hand in front of my chest, fingers curled inwards as if in holding something. My incantation finished just in time, as the 2nd and 3rd tomahawks bounced off my invisible shield. The creature stalked out of the fog, giving me my first good look at the infamous sheep rustler. Half-ogres. The offspring of a human male and an ogre female, never the other way around, since the size of the child would surely kill a human mother. It is said that this sort of breeding happens during the unholy rituals of some of the old gods. Less frequently, it might be the result of an ogre female capturing a human male and having a bit of fun before dispatching him. Whatever the circumstances of his birth, this particular half-ogre was holding a massive club in one hand. He was wearing a sheepskin loincloth and not much else. The creature had rage in his hazy yellow eyes. I quickly backpedaled until I was on the path between the two hills, keeping my shield up just in case the creature was dumb enough to throw that club. Sadly, he did not. Instead, the 8-foot-tall beast started to circle. He slowly tightened his spiral until he was well within range for a melee assault. I dodged the first swing, though it was probably a fraction too high to hit my head either way. Using the half-ogre's recovery time from that off-balanced attack, I reached into my pouch with a free hand. Grabbing a component from one of the little slots inside made me feel a bit more prepared. I just needed him to circle a little bit more. Sadly, as the half-ogre circled, he also swung. From my right side, the club whistled in at the perfect height, with all of the rage and power that the wielder's species was known for. My invisible shield shattered under the impact, and some of the momentum carried the swing through until weathered wood met fragile ribs. My vision flashed white as an unbidden scream was torn from my throat. The pain, as well as the energy from the clubbing, caused me to stagger a few feet to the left, which is exactly where I needed to be. Now it was my turn to break some ribs. The material that I had palmed remained, as it wasn't for this particular spell. I unleashed my force bolt, and it struck the half-ogre on the left side. He staggered back, finding himself against the steep, rocky incline of the neighboring hill. Disturbingly, he didn't make a single sound of pain. His counterattack was immediate and vicious, drawing and throwing his final tomahawk in a single underhanded motion. The spinning blade struck my left shoulder a glancing blow. It was mostly a flesh wound, but it started to bleed heavily given how quickly my heart was racing. Fighting through the pain, casting from one knee, I sent a stream of supernaturally strong webbing flying towards my feral foe. He looked confused for a moment, until he realized that he was trapped up against the steep face of that rocky hill. He let out a frustrated scream. The sound that echoed through the valley was something between the cry of an angry child and the bellow of a wounded buffalo. The drain on my mind was noticeable now. If I had been at my peak intelligence, I might have headed for higher ground to wage a long war of attrition, but my less intelligent, more angry persona fished out some beetle innards. As the creature tore free of the webs, a volley of green acidic bolts flew from my fingertips. They peppered that broad chest. The sizzling and smoking was horrific. The wounded thief was quickly free of his bonds. Enraged, he charged my position with that club held aloft. Again, a smarter me would have assessed all of the options available, would have considered a downhill retreat. Bounding down these hills would be easier to navigate on my smaller legs than on my opponent's huge tree trunks. But the less intelligent me had only one thing on his mind. Let's do that again. The final major spell that I had prepared was the same as the last. This time, the acidic bolts sailed in on their target from 5 paces away. Each impact was a sickening hiss. I thought something had gone wrong for a split second. There was a black spot with a silver glow on the half-ogre's chest that I couldn't account for. It was only when the creature fell to his knees a scant 2 paces away from me that I realized the truth. I was seeing the moonlight reflect off of the rocky hill behind my foe. The last acid bolt spell had hollowed out his chest, burned out his heart, and left a hole clean through the beast's back. Every movement brought a fresh wave of pain, but the alternative to moving was not moving, and that would eventually mean death. So, although everything I would do over the course of the next day would be slow and agonizing, I got on with it. Tomahawks were gathered, and one used to cut off the half-ogre's ear as confirmation of the completed bounty. Next, I performed the binding of my wounds as best I could. Finally, I found the creature's trail and trekked back towards its lair. It was an hour into the foothills before I found what I was looking for, though it must be said that what I found was not what I expected, even in my relatively stupid state. In a dark nook, where 3 hills met and dropped off, a crude wooden gate and a primitive shelter had been constructed. The thief hadn't been stealing sheep and rams for the meat. At least, not directly. He had kept them alive. He was breeding them, in fact. There were pens filled with creatures, the older ones bearing the semi-permanent paint marks of various farms, while the younger ones were unbranded. Clearly, the plan was to breed up a significant meat supply with his stolen livestock, sacrificing only grass and water in the process. As the sheep were unmolested, this was probably a safe place to rest. I took the most comfortable spot within the half-ogre's smelly little lean-to, and slept. The morning brought with it more pain, of course, but more importantly, the opportunity to transition into my intelligence-building spell set. Between enhancements and augmentations, I took inventory of my gains. There was a smattering of silver and copper coins, which would be a welcome resupply for my intelligence enhancement material components. Rations in such a bad state, only a half-ogre could stomach them. A dagger that was actually very fine in quality, something that I would have bought myself prior to this mission if I was flush with funds, and a small cast-iron pot in excellent condition. All said, it wasn't much of a haul. Perhaps the extra sheep would yield some gold from one of the ranchers. However, it was clear that the main financial gain was going to be the bounty itself. As a matter of habit, because Shaman would have done it if he were here, I cast a detect magic cantrip on the small loot pile. And something glowed other than my amulet. I rubbed my eyes, half thinking I was imagining this, but the glow remained. And the source of the glow was none other than that small cast-iron pot, of all things. I examined it for an inscription, and sure enough, something was written on the bottom in letters that shined through the pot's revealed aura. But it was nothing that I could read at the moment. I strapped my new dagger to my belt and put everything of value into my new pot. Spirits lifted, I heaped some grass into the pens from a supply that the former resident had collected. They seemed to get the picture and started to munch away. I left my new charges to their rather bland breakfast. Fighting through the ache in my ribcage, I made my way back to the original camp. Though it took a few hours longer than a healthy orc would have managed, I packed up my things and then headed down to one of the farms that was named on the bounty. The landowner was suspicious to receive a bulky, hobbling visitor with his face buried in the hood of a cloak, but that suspicion rapidly turned to joy when I told him the good news. He took the ear as proof and sent one of his daughters on horseback to check on the location of the stolen sheep. While waiting for confirmation, other local farmers were gathered, and they were told that most of their missing livestock were fine. There was both hooting and hollering. Eventually, one of the farmers agreed to buy the offspring, which was technically my property, as it wasn't covered by the bounty. We settled on a price of 5 gold and a wagon ride back into town. It was a good price for him and a welcome mode of transport for this wounded orc. Eventually, the daughter came back, looking quite pale. She dismounted without a word and stared at the gathered men. After an awkward moment, her father asked, "Well, is it true? They're all up there?" She nodded mutely, then turned her wide-eyed gaze on me for some reason. The farmers celebrated, more hooting, more hollering, but the father peered curiously at his daughter once again. "What's wrong?" She cleared her throat and then got up the courage to murmur,
"Yonder, sir, seems to have burned a hole clean through the thief's chest, Pa."
There was a moment of silence from the farmers as all eyes turned on me. I felt suddenly unsafe and looked up at the nearby horse as a possible escape route. Then an anonymous voice near the back of the pack of humans said,
"Way hey!"
And the rest of them started cheering once again, except for the daughter who wandered inside to find something alcoholic to imbibe. The farmers happily signed confirmation that the contract was complete and wished me luck on my journeys. The extra 5 gold pieces arrived when my ride back into Limpt did, and I thanked the young man that handed it to me almost as heartily as the farmers had thanked me. He gave me a shy smile, then said,
"Hop in the back, mister. Should be nice and soft with all the wool piled up."
With a fully rested team of horses and no need to stop for investigation, stealth, or resupply, the trip back into town was rapid. We arrived a couple hours after nightfall, and I was dropped off just a single block from the magic shop. I bid the lad a good time at market tomorrow and a safe trip back. Then I walked the final leg of my round-trip journey. I threw half a dozen pebbles at the upstairs window before I saw a friendly face peer down at me. In no time at all, my friends were ushering me inside. Rick went to make some tea, while Will admonished me over the state of my body. Begrudgingly, the smaller human admitted that the bandaging job was pretty good, but suggested we see a cleric in the morning. Rick was returning with a steaming mug when the topic of a cleric came up.
A very good idea, Salt, as you don't want your wounds to fester or heal badly.
He handed the drink over.
They'll expect a donation of a few gold for the service, however, which should be all right if your trip was a success.
I filled them in on all of the details. Of course, they were most excited about the pot. Will took the cast-iron pot over to the front counter as he said,
We really have to teach you the cantrip to read magic inscriptions. Cleverly called, Read Magic. We can have a go in the morning. I have a spare jeweler's loop I can give you. It doesn't get consumed by the spell, so you can use it over and over.
I nodded, then glanced at Rick. He looked like he might be thinking the same thing. Will had far too much energy and enthusiasm for this time of night. The smaller human cast his spell, then peered at the bottom of the pot through the loop.
Aha! Minotaur scribing. Mm-hmm. Okay. Salt, this is a self-heating pot. 3 times in a day you can touch the handle or the side and say the word blaze. The pot will heat up, as in if over a hot campfire, for up to 1 hour, and then instantly turn itself off. Or you can force it to cool back down by touching the handle and saying the key word again before the time expires. Cute!
Rick explained.
These sorts of minor items are made by apprentices who are getting into the crafting magics. In this case, a minotaur likely apprenticing to an elf lord or some such thing. We can sell it for you if you like. After commission, you might see 30 gold, maybe more.
I shook my head. Oh no, I'm keeping this, it's amazing. They both laughed a little at my enthusiasm.
It is amazing. I've seen a skillet like this, but never a pot. Even though it's minor magic, it still saves a lot of work. I'm glad you like it, said Will.
Rick rose as I finished my tea.
Come on, I'll help you to unpack, and then let's get you to the Temple of Inara. I see some seepage coming from those bandages. It might not be wise to wait for the morning. It's a short walk, and they have services up until midnight. Our pastor will fix you up.
As it turned out, broken ribs were considered a minor healing feat that one of the apprentices could take care of. The suggested donation for the service was 10 gold, but only 5 gold pieces for parishioners, which Will and Rick were. I paid the 5 gold gladly, and the 2 humans attended confession as I was worked on. By the time the brown, cassocked young priest was done, my ribs felt much better. Still sore, but moving around and breathing didn't hurt nearly as much, and I didn't have to worry about them healing badly. The apprentice priest even rebandaged my remaining wounds afterwards for no additional charge. It would be clear to the young cleric what my race was after seeing the flesh of my injured shoulder, but he didn't seem to mind.
Rick and Will are waiting outside. Walk in grace, the young man murmured after he was finished.
As I was walking out of the temple, the bishop placed a gentle hand on my good shoulder. He was an older man dressed in crimson robes, wearing spectacles and a mitre. He murmured softly,
They're good kids, those two. To bring you in here under the blanket of their membership, that means they think of you as family. I'm glad you have each other.
Those kind, informative words had an immediate impact on me. I'm sure that the older human could see the tears falling to the floor, sourced from eyes hidden deep in the hood of my cloak. All I could manage in a gruff tone was to reply, I'm glad too. Good night, Padre. My human friends didn't say a word as I joined them for the walk home. They saw I was emotional. Perhaps they thought I had a religious experience. Perhaps, in my own way, I did. It was the storeroom for me once again. Quite the comfort after rainy days and night on the road. As I performed my nightly rituals, I went over my finances in my head. After turning in the contract, I would have 40 gold. 25 of that was set aside for 5 weeks of supplies and lodging near the docks, which would take me right up to Will and Rick's next expedition. A couple of gold to replace some material components and travel rations. One gold to cover the ink I've been using here. The least I could do since I was being taught how to cast the Reed Magic Cantrip in the morning. I would have Rick and Will sell the tomahawks as well, keeping the proceeds to help cover my temporary room and board. That left 12 gold. 9 for myself, 3 for Shaman. Well, it was a start. Chapter 8. My little apartment was right on the waterfront. I had asked Rick if that increased the rental price, but he assured me that it actually brought the weekly rent down. Apparently the nearby fish processing warehouse bothered some tenants. I honestly took very little notice of the smell. It was still better than the fetid rotting of the swamp back home. I had a view of the ships coming in. Fishing vessels of all sizes regularly visited the docks, of course, but all manner of shipping and pleasure boats made their way through the harbor as well. When I wasn't deep in study or resting, I would absently count the sails or the oars used to drive these naval beasts through the relatively calm waters close to shore. Oftentimes a ship would come in with incredible battle scars. These would sometimes come in the form of broken planks and burnt sails in the case of piracy. Other times, a ship with a broken mast would limp in, having barely won an encounter with nature itself. Just about every one of them had losses of some sort, and yet every one of them was beautiful. Resting and recovering was the plan, at least for my first 2 weeks back in town. Not only did I need to recover bodily, I needed to recover mentally. The pain took me out of my normal routine. Only in the second week could I really build my mind back up to full potential. Rick and Will were instrumental in helping me to find the road back to full health. Their companionship, their tutelage, and even their cooking contributed to my being made whole. When I wasn't with my new friends, I was building a foundation in the mystical arts. I wanted to be ready to attend the Arcane University should they accept my application. However, there were things that children with magical aptitude learned in their early years. These things, theory, history, ritual, these were gaps in my magical foundation. In order to fill these gaps, I needed books. But the books I would need were not the same books one would give a human or elven apprentice. I was versed in a different breed of magic. My magic juggled the permanent resources of power and memory with the spendable resource of raw intellect. Humans and elves did not need to worry about their intelligence draining away, nor did their allies, nor did their kin. So some of the books that I needed would have to focus on the era when the orcish curse was first weaved. There might even be tomes that tell of the times before the curse, when orc mages walked the land freely and practiced some of the most advanced magic on Panos. These books could get expensive, even though they didn't contain a single spell. From what Will and Rick told me, they were not in high demand. But in some ways that could be more expensive. Getting these obscure texts shipped or transcribed had a significant price tag. Some of them were even in Orcish, and human scribes who spoke and wrote the language were specialists. Again, not cheap. We would be leaving on our expedition in the second week of mid-fall, and I really wanted to place the most important transcription and purchase orders prior to leaving. Luckily, Will had a couple of tasks in mind that would allow me to pay for my small library. A young lord, quite magically advanced for his age, was interested in the augmented intelligence spell. However, the human lad wished to learn from the person who created the spell. His family was willing to pay for the privilege, and my share would cover almost 2/3 of the fees that I would need to pay for my new library. I had conditions, and if the family didn't agree to all of them, I wouldn't take the job. There was to be no outside observation. My identity was not to be researched or divulged once discovered. The spell was not to be shared with others without a representative of the magic shop screening their suitability, and a bonding curse would be cast by Rick upon the student to assure that the terms were kept. I thought that the family would reject those terms outright, or perhaps come back with a counteroffer that I would likely refuse. Instead, they simply agreed. And so I found myself in the small, walled garden behind the shop, sitting in an old but sturdy wooden chair, waiting for my first student outside of the couple hours spent on tutoring levitation. I wore no hood, no gloves, nothing to hide the weathered green skin that I would normally obfuscate. If the boy wanted to know where this spell came from, he would find out. Besides, with the bonding curse in place, he wouldn't be telling anyone about my true origins. The young man strode into the garden with the bearing of a confident lord, but his stride broke noticeably upon regarding my visage. Fine. Let him look. Let it sink in. To his credit, the teenager may have slowed, but he didn't stop. He took the chair opposite me, gaze never leaving my face.
"You are the creator of the spell, sir?"
the raven-haired lad asked quietly. "I am, though I'm not a sir by any measure. You can call me Sorch." I offered a hand to shake. When the noble son took my hand, I was amused by the contrast. His hand was small and pale, like soft ivory. Mine was calloused, pitted, the color of moss. We shook, and then I leaned back in my seat to regard my young charge. "Your young Lord Leeson, yes? Aged 16? And attending the Youth Academy?" He nodded quickly. Easy questions were just what he needed right now.
"Yes, sir. Sorch. I should be going into the full university program in a year, if I pass the entry criteria."
I raised a brow. The young man squirmed a little in his seat as I regarded him. "What's that, 2 years early? You must be hell on your teachers." That actually made him smile a bit.
"So I'm told, though I do try to remain respectful at all times."
I nodded. "I'm certain that's true, Leeson. Well, for the next week at least, I want you to speak your mind. We need to be efficient about this so there's no room for lizard crap. Agreed?" He blinked a couple of times at the phrase lizard crap, probably more used to the bovine reference, but eventually his little head was nodding.
"Yes, agreed, of course. I'll provide the kind of feedback that will be helpful in the learning process."
I snorted. "Your family is in politics, I can tell. It's that careful wording, erring on the side of kindness, but also just slightly generic. There's no need for that. I can tell you have questions, ask them plainly. I'll do my best to answer them." I had barely finished my sentence, and the young man was already leaning forward and blurting out,
"When did you get transformed into an orc? Was it a magical duel?"
I laughed, the sound echoing back at the both of us in the tight confines of the garden. "I was transformed into an orc at birth." "Right. I guess it's story time." In fact, the entirety of that first session was Leeson asking questions about orcs, but in a constructive way that I had to applaud. Much like I needed to understand the framework of human and elven magic, the young lord wanted to know about how magic worked amongst the orcs, and of course he particularly wanted to know about my experiences and history. All of it was recorded as a preamble in his spellbook. That was clever, since personal notes were not forbidden by the terms of the agreement, so long as he didn't intentionally show them to others. I had to admit, it felt good. It felt good to be able to speak about my time and my trials without censoring myself. My student would be bound to the terms of the agreement, but even if he wasn't, I would have told him these things. He was polite and inquisitive, and projected an aura of trustworthiness. The young lord had insisted on learning from the spell's creator, but likely hadn't dreamed that the learning would be of such an alien nature. Leeson was more than happy to spend the session reviewing the magical ways of the Jawafa clan and my own path towards enlightenment. We talked through our light lunch of bread, walnuts, and cheese. By the time I had caught him up to the modern day, the sun was starting to set behind the garden wall. He had already added several pages of background to his spellbook. It was possibly the most complete account of modern orc sorcery written in common. "That's all for today. Tomorrow we'll get into the material component of silver and why it was chosen. I'll perform the first casting, and we'll start to break down the words and the gestures as well." Leeson sprinkled some fine sand on the fresh ink, then blew off the excess. He started to pack up his study materials.
Thank you, Sort. When I came here today, I thought, well, I never thought it would be anything like this.
He sounded pleased. This was probably the most exciting thing that his education had ever exposed him to. I tilted my head. You know what? Neither did I. Not sure what I expected, to be honest, but this wasn't painful at all. The young lord laughed at that.
I think you'd make a great teacher if you chose to pursue it full time.
He paused and then amended his statement.
Well, in the right group, with open-minded students.
I snorted and then waved him off. Good night, young man. Will and Rick were eager to hear about how the first session went. After I assured them that there would be no angry noble family demanding a refund, we sat down to dinner. They insisted that it was the least they could do to earn their share of the commission. I agreed, and proceeded to make half of a roasted chicken disappear. The next day I found myself cutting my morning studies short. I was eager to get back to tutoring, so much so that I showed up at the magic shop half an hour early. Unsurprisingly, so had my young charge. I put a big, gloved hand on his shoulder, and wordlessly led him into the back garden. Once I had shucked my cloak and gloves, and once Leeson had set up his writing paraphernalia, we began. We started by discussing silver as a component. After talking about elemental rarity and the value of a sacrifice within the realm of magic, we discussed progression. I explained, frankly, using silver was just easier. I was basing a spell upon another spell. What was I hoping to accomplish? I wanted a larger effect, so the material component could, in theory, be a more valuable or more rare version of the original. Leeson nodded slowly.
But wasn't there a risk of simply going too big? A risk of burning the candle too brightly?
I considered how to phrase my methodology in the common tongue. Finally, I settled on a plumbing metaphor. There would be, yes, if I had kept the entirety of the first spell's framework. Imagine that the first spell used the structure of a moonshine distillery. I paused to make sure that he understood the context. From his slightly guilty look, I knew that he had. I continued. The pipes used to heat the liquids and carry the steam are small, narrow. Good enough for that purpose, but not for a more grand task. I replaced that structure with that of, to use a real-world example, a hand pump for a well. The effort to produce a result is greater because more volume needs to be moved and larger pipes are being used, but the result itself is also greater. And that's what I did with the spell. I retooled the framework, upgraded it so that it could handle the volume of power and the greater sacrifice of silver over copper. The noble lad nodded, scribbling furiously in his spellbook. I took out a bit of silver. This is the minimum amount of silver that you need. This piece was part of a set of coins that I had a blacksmith heat up and fracture as he was waiting for his forge to reach iron handling temperature. Even if it cost me a few silver for his time, the process doubled my supply, adding weeks to my regular routine. Always use the minimum when possible. Waste not, want not. The black-haired teen chuckled a bit.
You don't have to convince me. My father tracks every piece of copper. Not that he isn't generous, mind you, and clearly he'll pay top gold for services that he thinks are worthwhile, such as your own. But the concept of waste is something he doesn't abide by.
I smiled and nodded. I had learned not to show as many teeth when I smiled around Leeson, as a more toothy grin seemed to turn him a shade paler than he was already. Good. Well, you understand the component. Now let me show you the spell itself. We'll go through each part individually in the next few days, so just pay attention to the whole process right now. He set aside his writing materials. If he leaned forward with any more enthusiasm, he would fall right out of his chair. Casting the spell was second nature to me now. It was like breathing. I hardly felt the silver slip from this plane of existence into the next. I did feel the mental rush, followed by the lesser mental drain. Oh, how I envied Leeson in some ways. He would never feel the drain, not until the spell was over. The augmentation would work even better for him than it did for me, the mage who created it. I opened my eyes to see those brown eyes peering back at me. He said,
"For a moment, it was as if you were in your own world."
I nodded. "For a moment, I was." We discussed some of the linguistic differences between my brand of magic and what the lad was used to. I assured him that it wouldn't be difficult, and that Will and Rick had mastered the spell using traditional incantation methods. I did have a racially specific footnote for the young man. After seeing my human friends cast the spell, I should note that it makes those of the smaller races quite tired. As you know, the copper version of the spell is a physical drain, like recovering after running a short sprint. My version of the spell hits you like you've been running for a couple of miles. For someone with orcish constitution, that isn't much of a problem, but Rick and Will needed an extended sit-down after the casting. I wouldn't attempt it if you're already tired or physically exerted. There was a knock on the door leading into the walled garden. Ah, right. As a surprise, your mother apparently sent some less humble fare for lunch. Something called brisket, I believe. That's when I discovered that I loved brisket. As I cleaned my plate with a piece of soft bread, the teenager asked,
"Now that you've been here and seen more of the world and tried these new things, would you ever go back to your home?"
The answer was out of my lips before I could even think about the ramifications. No. I paused, then clarified. No, I wouldn't go back in any permanent way. I have a dear friend there by the name of Shaman, and I miss him. I do plan to go back and see him. I do plan to improve the life of my clan however I can. But that life isn't one that I can go back to. The lad nodded. I finished my bread and started to stack plates and cups as the young human finished his meal. All the while, I reflected on the force and certainty of my initial answer. That no was guttural, instinctive. I didn't even know that I felt that strongly until the young man asked. Technical drills took up the rest of the second day and the entire third day of Leeson's tutoring. Finger positions, rote memorization of the incantation, copying the spell into his book. The young lord was a technical genius, and in some ways I improved my own technique while adapting the spell to his particular methods. It was clear that Leeson was moving from strength to strength. His mind was agile, as were his fingers. His voice was strong, as was his will. Having worked with him for just 3 days, I understood. I understood why he was 2 years ahead of his classes. I understood why he had such a passion for magic. And I understood why he wanted to go right to the source when learning this new spell. He would undoubtedly create some of his own one day. Which made the fourth day even more of a mystery to me. Try as he might, even understanding each component of the spell individually, the young lord couldn't seem to cast the spell. The silver sacrifice stayed in his hand. There was no sensation of inspiration, no hint of mental enhancement. He watched me perform the spell twice more, but that only seemed to fuel his frustration. After countless attempts, I called it a day. To the lad's credit, he wasn't angry with me, but he was clearly angry at himself. I discussed the situation with Rick and Will at dinner that night. "He's brilliant. He understands all of the concepts. It looks like he's doing everything correctly, and then nothing happens." Will shrugged.
"Maybe he isn't ready for that level of power yet. We didn't really check into his mastery levels. We were told secondhand that he had a grasp of some of the advanced techniques, but didn't personally observe them."
Rick aside to Will.
"Mary Johansson said that they had mastered some second-year spells, so the raw power should be present."
The taller human absently sprinkled salt over his baked potato.
"It's difficult to know what's in a student's mind when they're casting a spell. A mental distraction or aberration is more than enough to stop a spell from working."
I latched on to that theory. "What do you mean?" Rick shrugged.
"I mean, Will, what was it that Arcanist Voden said about preparing your mind for elemental spells?"
The smaller human looked like he was deep in thought for a few seconds. Then he recalled,
"Oh, right.
When you're casting fire magic, you need to be aware of your intentions. Even the thought of water or ice or moisture could cause the spell to fizzle. He called it subjective clarity. Does that help you, Sorge?
My mind was racing. Rick, when you use the spell, what's in your mind? He hesitated, but I insisted. Be honest, I won't be insulted. Finally, the human answered.
Money? I mean, it's a fine spell, Sorge, but not one that I would personally use every day. It takes away from the volume of spells that I can cast, and the benefit to me personally is questionable unless I have some kind of intensive study session I would need to attend.
I turned my gaze to Will, but he was already nodding.
Profit, yes. Same here.
I murmured to myself. And for me, it's advancement, knowledge, power. We ate in silence for a little while. Finally, Rick asked,
Do you think you know what's happening then, Sorge?
I think I might. If you'll excuse me, I need to head home immediately after dinner. There's something I need to look up. I burned the midnight oil, not to read some obscure text, but to review my own notes, particularly the diary entries that I had made just after I got the spell to work in the first place. Suddenly, it all fell into place. I had discovered the missing element that would make a spell work for a poor orc and a couple of shopkeepers, but not a privileged and intelligent young man. I walked into our fifth and final tutorial session with confidence. Leeson was slouched in his seat, looking a bit defeated. We couldn't be more different in that moment. It was time to bring the lad down to my level. So, after reviewing my notes, I believe I know why the spell isn't working for you, Leeson. He glanced up at me, daring to have a little bit of hope.
Yes?
It's because you're a ponce. For a lad so pale, who knew that he could summon so much blood to his cheeks?
Excuse me?
The teenager sputtered, clearly angry. I yawned.
You know, a fop, a dandy, a hairdo.
Leeson stood up, fists clenched.
How dare you? You know nothing about me.
A toothy smirk was my reply, but I added for good measure. I know that this spell requires something that you don't have. Need. It requires you to need something and to have the ambition and the desire to reach out and grab it. You don't need anything. You can just send out a servant for whatever you want, or you can ask Mommy and Daddy. The young noble was shaking with rage.
I have ambition. What in the hells do you know anyway, you glorified swamp rat? I've earned my place in the world of magic. Nothing was handed to me.
I shouted right back at him, this time hurling a piece of silver at him, which he caught deftly. Then cast the damn spell, boy, or quit wasting my time. And he did. That transformation from angry young man prior to casting the spell to consummate magician during the casting to beatific cherub as he basked in the intellectual rush of augmented intelligence, it was a beautiful thing to watch.
Oh,
was all he said afterwards, eyes unfocused as he coped with this new sensation. I was grinning ear to ear. As he adjusted to the augmentation, I explained, The missing element was drive, Leeson. We were treating this like a technical exercise, and technically you were doing all of the right stuff and things. But when I cast the spell, it's my life's blood. When Rick and Will cast the spell, it's about their livelihood. The spell has to be an expression of genuine need, genuine desire. Your desire to advance in the world of magic and be independent are excellent examples. I'm going to update my notes and have the lads update theirs as well. He took a few deep breaths. The red in his cheeks was no longer anger. It was shame.
Sorge, I didn't mean what I said about being a swamp rat. I do apologize. I was just...
I waved the apology off. You were angry, and I made you angry, and that was intentional and entirely my own doing. It should be noted that you are not in any way a ponce or a fop. You're a remarkable young man. Just look what you've achieved. You're the first outside my circle of friends to cast this spell. Now it was Leeson's turn to smile.
I had a good teacher.
Yes, well, let's not pack up the wagon just yet. We'll spend the rest of the day deconstructing the spell. You can have a nap after lunch so that you're ready to memorize it again, and we'll make sure that you can summon that desire into your mind in a less stressful circumstance. After the rush of being able to cast the spell wore off, Leeson needed to sit down. I wasn't exaggerating when I outlined the after-effects of augmented intelligence on humans. The young man looked like he had been lifting heavy weights all morning. I filled the next hour of tutoring time by giving the lad a verbal critique of his performance. That allowed him to get his wind back. After lunch and a brief period of sleep, we both memorized our spells once again. As I predicted, the young noble was able to recast the spell after a good rest. His technique was, if anything, better than my own. We both made some final notes and started to pack up for the day. But before he went away to partake in his family's weekend activities, I had a little surprise to spring upon him. The sun was setting over Limpt as I unwrapped our little treat and showed the human.
Are you sure this is all right?
The lad stammered, looking at the glass of port wine that had been poured in his honor. I snorted. Asks the lad who quite clearly knows a thing or two about distilling white lightning. I took a sip from my own glass. My eyes slowly closed in visceral pleasure as the heat of the alcohol and the wonderful fruity tang washed over my senses. Besides, it had better be all right. Your father sent the bottle. He chuckled.
Oh, all right then.
The raven-haired lad raised his glass silently to toast his father from halfway across town. Then he, too, imbibed, and melted in his seat as the powerful port washed over him.
Oh, this is from the old cellar?
I nodded. It was the best wine I had ever tasted, though admittedly I didn't have a lot to compare it to. So what's next for you, Leeson? He licked his lips before taking another long sip.
In a couple of weeks I'm taking my finals, the youth magic exams. They determine a lot of things, one of them being possible placement at the Arcane University. I'll be putting your spell to good use as I study.
I raised an eyebrow. Ah, so the timing of this was quite deliberate. I'm glad it worked out for you. Best of luck on your tests. He chuckled a bit.
I want to get in. I didn't want to wait another year. I'm ready.
He glanced up from his glass to look me in the eye.
What's next for you, Sort?
I let another portion of the lovely quaff roll over my tongue and down my throat before I answered the young man. I'm going to be a caravan guard, and then I'll be participating in Will and Rick's northern expedition. Departure is only a couple of weeks away now. Leeson raised his glass to me, and I to him. We finished our victory drink in silence, both of us already thinking ahead to the next big chapter in our lives.
Chapter 9. The bishop, garbed in a red short-sleeved knit vest and matching silk pants, jotted down some notes in a neat, tight script.
And you said you'd prefer the first edition of The Start of Things to Come, correct?
I nodded. If that's possible. I have to stay within my budget, of course, so the second edition will have to do if access to the first will be expensive. The leader of the Temple of Venora nodded his understanding.
We'll treat your money as a single pool so as not to go over budget. Don't worry about that, young man. All fees, including our commission, will be accounted for in advance.
He puffed out his chest a bit.
And given my legendary powers of negotiation, I believe you can expect at least half a dozen of the high-priority items on your list.
I chuckled softly. I leave the matter in your more than capable hands, Padre. Will and Rick send their regards. I bowed, travel cloak rustling. The older clergyman returned the bow.
Kind of you to relay that, Sort. May Venora bless you and keep you all, and may your upcoming journey be a great success.
I left the temple with a spring in my step. The next 3 weeks would be an adventure unlike any that I had experienced in my life. It was more than a trip into the mountains. It was an outing with my new friends and companions. They showed me their trust twice over, using their influence to get me hired on as a fellow caravan guard and signing me on as a junior partner on their subsequent mountain expedition near the city of Ice House. This meant that I would achieve short-term stability in my financial situation. The 60 gold that the caravan job paid would easily cover my rent on the dockside apartment for the duration of our trip. I had the caravan company pay the fee directly to my landlord. Given his rather colorful nature, I made sure to get the receipt in writing. The potential profits from the expedition were, of course, unknown. The nature of exploration and adventure is risk, and the reward is never certain. On average, the guys said that their share of the proceeds topped 1,000 gold pieces worth of merchandise that they could resell in the magic shop. On this trip, the profits would be split 9 ways, with each of the senior partners getting 2 shares and myself getting 1. So, if all went well, and this was an average trip, I could end up with at least a couple of 100 gold pieces. Not bad for a month on the road. As numbers and ambitions danced through my head, I made my way to the northern tip of Limpt. The north gate out of the city was affectionately known as Adventure Alley. The reason was clear. The eastern and western gates into Limpt carried day-to-day caravan traffic, just normal shipping throughout the territory and up and down the coast. You know, boring stuff and things. The northern gate was only used for longer and more dangerous journeys. The road only led to Ice House, which was both an adventuring hub and the gateway to the northern continent. Thus, Adventure Alley. Outside of the north gate was a collection of large compounds, each one belonging to one of the major caravan companies. Their services were not cheap. Most grains, cotton, certain kinds of vegetables, and the vast majority of fish had to be shipped into Ice House. So the cost of living, as one might imagine, was quite high. These caravan companies profited from the shipping of scarcities into Ice House, trade and messaging between the northern and southern continents, and shipping spoils of the adventure trade back to the southern cities. They could also take advantage of price differences between Ice House and Limpt, if they had spare capacity. For example, fish was far easier to catch in the ocean than in the occasional unfrozen stream or underwater lake found in the mountains. Quickly packed and salted, the relatively cheap commodity could be sent to Ice House at a severe markup. And once they arrived, the naturally frozen state of things near Ice House made storage of fish and meat a trivial thing. I was particularly excited to be meeting one of the other full partners on the expedition. Apparently, Rick and Will knew this partner from the Arcane University, even though he wasn't a mage. They seemed to delight in telling me absolutely nothing about this man, simply informing me that it would be worth the wait to find out about him in person. I played along, not wanting to be a spoilsport. The fourth and final full partner I would apparently rendezvous with up in Ice House. The guys were being even more mysterious about our final adventuring companion. They didn't take any satisfaction in that particular vagueness, however. Will and Rick genuinely didn't know much about the personal life and history of the final partner, outside of their talents and their reliability. I made my way to the compound of Advanced Scouting and Commerce, the particular caravan company that we would be working for and traveling with on this trip. The wooden sign hanging from the administrative building, which I was able to read quite easily given my improved common, said, "Need something? Just ask. A-S-C." I groaned softly at the pun. Rather than walk into the office to inquire about my companions, my gaze was drawn deeper into the compound by a series of hoots and whistles. 2 conspicuous humans were waving frantically in my direction. The smaller man was even jumping up and down, as if it were possible to miss Rick and Will making such a racket. I walked over to them, dodging porters and caravan managers as they finished securing cargo across the 2 dozen horse-drawn wagons. Rick gave me a handshake, and Will gave me a surprise hug. I was still getting used to friendly physical affection. It was unheard of in my tribe, and in any tribe I had ever had dealings with. I discovered that it made Will smile when I thumped him on the back and squeezed his shoulder.
For a moment, I pondered what would happen if I tried to hug Shaman as a casual greeting. He would probably have Lizzie bite me. Greetings done, Rick excused himself so that he could supervise loading the magic shop's own cargo. Will mentioned,
"Our guard duty pays for the transport of 2 large trunks, so we take orders from merchants and ice house, due for delivery every other season. It pays for the help that we hire to keep the shop running while we're away, and most of the expedition's expenses. I'm going to square away the invoices, so feel free to..." "Oh, hey, you should meet Toby, our partner. He's in the second tent to the left, just over there."
I glanced over to where the small human was pointing. "It would be my pleasure." I started to head towards the tent in question.
"Oh, Sorch?"
I paused. "Yes, Will?"
Don't freak out, okay?"
I paused to reply. "Of course not." Then I headed over to the tall, dusty tent. I might not be worldly like my new friends, but I could certainly stay composed when meeting a business partner. I opened the tent flap and stepped inside. I mean, did Will think I was some sort of holy lizard crap? The words fell from my lips before I could restrain myself. Even with Will's warning, I was ill-prepared. Toby was... there was no other way to describe him. Toby was a minotaur. A bull man standing my height and half my height again. He towered over me. Golden brown fur covered the parts of the great beast's body that were not covered by chainmail and leather. He wore no boots at the moment, preferring to allow his well-groomed hooves to meet the ground unshod. Thick black horns curled above the minotaur's alertly perked ears. But what really surprised me was that jovial, booming laughter. "Holy lizard crap, indeed. If my nose does not fail me, I smell an orc. That's amazing. Rick said that I would be surprised by our new junior partner, and he was right. Step into the lamplight, please, and let me see you without the silly hood up." It was like Toby's voice penetrated my skin and shook my very bones. It wasn't just the volume, it was also the baritone timbre of the bullman's voice. Despite this, I felt oddly at ease. He seemed to be in an excellent mood. One might even say he was jolly. I removed my hood and my gloves. "Pardon my outburst, sir. I haven't ever met one of your kind. If I might say so, sir, you are a physically impressive specimen." As I had been asked, I stepped into the lamplight so that it illuminated my green-hued skin. Toby grinned. His teeth were perfectly white and perfectly square, the picture of perfect dental hygiene. "You are always allowed to speak the truth in my presence, Sorch the Orc. I encourage it. In my case, I have met others of your kind. I've met orcs in both neutral and adversarial situations, but I'm happy to have the chance to ally with such a well-spoken representative of the species." I'm not sure why, but something about the Minotaur's tone made me believe that his words went beyond flattery. The sincere compliment brought a slight flush to my cheeks. I stammered and managed a subdued murmur of thanks. The Minotaur reached into his pack and produced a sky-blue tabard. He slid the piece of cloth over his head. When it came to rest, I saw the religious symbols. Thanks to my recent studies, I was able to put two and two together. "You're a paladin," I murmured in disbelief. The large bullman flashed me a bright smile.
"Indeed I am. Aren't you so very observant? Aro Remset be praised. I will tell you all about myself on the trip, if you would do me the courtesy of doing the same. Time on the road can be long without tales told and souls bared."
"Of course I'd be happy to swap tales with you," I said without hesitation. I'm not certain if it was his enthusiasm or his upbeat demeanor or simply the novelty of the situation, but being around Toby simply felt good. It helped that the huge creature was instantly accepting of me. I had heard tales that a paladin could see into your heart if he wished, and find any evil intent. If that held true, whatever he saw in my heart didn't upset him at all. I suppose that was a relief, even to myself. Just then, there was a powerful cry from outside.
All gather instructions from the caravan master.
The Minotaur untied the peace knot on his massive broadsword, slung his backpack, and hefted his shield.
It's time, was all he said before leading the way out of the tent. I pulled up my hood, donned my gloves, and followed.